In a moment, James Fox joins us. We'll be talking with James about some incredible UFO stories. Later on tonight, Richard Dolan joins us. James is also bringing us Ricky Sorrells. You might remember the name. Linda Moulton Howe mentioned him during the Stephenville, Texas case. He was one of those few eyewitnesses who encountered the craft there. Ricky will join us in just a second as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. James Fox, born in England at 3 years old. He assisted his father as he traveled to locations for news stories. In 1993, James was introduced to the world of ufology by a very close friend, and he was very skeptical until he started to investigate on his own. And in 1998, he completed his first major documentary for the Discovery Channel, which included such notables as our dear friend Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell and the late Colonel Philip J. Corso, who was in charge of the Foreign Technology Desk at the Pentagon during the Eisenhower administration. James is with us tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, James, first of all, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Likewise. And also, we've got here Ricky Sorrells. Ricky was one of those few witnesses who encountered the craft at Stephenville, Texas, at very close range while deer hunting in the late afternoon. He stood directly under it for several minutes. As a metal worker, Ricky was at a loss to describe its construction. It hovered roughly 300 feet directly overhead, so big he couldn't see the edges from any direction. And when it took off, he said, well, he had blinked. He thought he would have missed it. Here he is, Ricky Sorrells. Hey, Ricky, how are you?
How are you this morning?
Good, good. Thanks for coming on with us. And I know you're going to have to run soon, but we did want to talk with you. And James, thanks for helping us out on this.
Absolutely.
Ricky, when you were standing underneath this craft and you said it was so big you couldn't even see the edges, did you see any texture to it?
No, you know, it just had the cones going up inside of it. It was a dull gray finish. You know, it wasn't shiny. You know, it had no bolts or seams or rivets or anything. Pretty straightforward deal, I guess.
Now, when the Air Force came out with their explanation that what you saw was an F-16 fighter jet, how did you react to that?
Oh, you know, it's just typical, I suppose. Since this has happened to me, I figured out real quick that this is a typical response that they give. But, you know, it wasn't no F-16.
What'd you think you saw, Ricky? Now you've had some time to think about this.
Right. You know, I still don't know if it's military or from another planet. It's definitely big, and if it's ours, you know, we're in good hands. If it's not ours, we're in trouble. And it was big. It was. I don't see anything like this can float and fly and go and do, but it does.
And fast. And very fast.
And very fast.
Any nightmares because of this, Ricky?
No nightmares, but a lot of lost sleep, you know?
Yeah.
Ricky, I think it's really interesting because one of the reasons why when I first met with Ricky when I was in Stephenville in January, I think it was January, early January, he met with me off camera. It was a series of events that led me to meet you, Ricky, and he would not go on the record, but he would tell us off the record what happened, and he took us all out to the spot in the forest. I was with my whole camera crew, and I was, of course, really upset that I couldn't turn the cameras on because the testimony was just riveting to all of us. But you had talked about the fact that the military was harassing you, and I think that was that and other things was something of concern. Ricky, talk a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. You know, there's so much that's happened. You know, I never dealt with anything like this before, and I didn't ask for it, but it happened. And, you know, I've had a guy that I'm pretty for sure that was military that came up to my house about 1 o'clock in the morning. My dog started barking, and I looked out the bedroom window, seen him standing there. Then I come around to the back door, you know, and on the way I grabbed my rifle and I looked out the back door, and I could see he'd moved over by my wood. And he was standing there. It was cold and sort of kind of drizzly, foggy, almost drizzly night like a night would be. And in Texas, the moon will shine through and illuminate. And I could see him very well. And we were looking at each other. And he kept sort of kind of like he was cold, rocking back and forth maybe. Or I'm thinking he was doing it so he, you know, he let me know that he was there. And then, you know, I've had, when all this happened, I received so many phone calls. It's just unreal. And I would, you know, I'd try to be nice, and I'd let everybody tell me who they were and where they're from. And I wasn't paying attention to who I was talking to, NBC, CBS, all these people. And I'd tell them, no, thank you. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with this. You know, I hadn't even had time to digest what had happened. And one of these phone calls started out, is this Ricky Sorrell? I said, yes. Then he said something, Lieutenant Colonel something. I went, what? And then we had a conversation. He was trying to figure out where I live. And, you know, during the course of the conversation, he was apparently on a cell phone right then trying to figure out where I was at. He wanted to come talk to me. And I didn't feel comfortable. And I told him, you know, no, I didn't want to talk with him. Had no desire. And it got pretty heated. And, you know, it got real heated. And just one of them things. I told him, you know, I asked him not to cross my cattle guard. And, you know, got pretty heated.
Was that the last you ever heard of any so-called governmental or military people, Ricky?
Yes. You know, I've had them fly over my place. You know, at first it was helicopters, just constant, flying in like a grid formation or grid pattern. And, you know, it got so bad one night that I'd been spotlighting for coyotes, and I had a spotlight in my truck at my back door. And I'd walked out there, and all I had on was my boots and my shorts, and I walked out there and turned that thing on, and the helicopter was coming over, and I shined it at one of them. And he was so close that, the, you know, I don't know anything about helicopters or airplanes, but it was so close that it was a pickup. The guy on the passenger side of the airplane picked his arm up, you know, I shined it right on him. Then the airplane or the helicopter immediately turned and came right to me, and they had a spotlight. And I figured I'd done messed up, so I dropped my spotlight and just waved at them and walked back into my house. They come over my house, went around, come back where they were at, and then they continued on while the other helicopters waited. And you know, it was after that I've had F-16s or F-15s, I'm not sure which ones, flying over. Then it dwindled down to single-engine airplanes at, you know, all hours in the morning, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I've had that kind of stuff. You know, Linda Moulton Howe came and visited me, and, you know, she, I took her back here, and she was videoing and everything, and you know, we actually found a live shell back in there, and it's not a caliber that I shoot or nobody that I allowed to go hunting on my place that shoots that caliber. So,
Ricky, did you ever talk with some of the other witnesses, and do they share the same views that you do?
Share the same views as far as
what they saw? And they kind of back you up?
Oh, yes. You know, I get a lot of people. You know, I buy and sell cows on my days off, and, you know, I know just about everybody around here. And I get a lot of phone calls, people wanting, telling me they saw this or that, or, you know, and, you know, it's a sad thing, but a lot of the people out in the country are older. There's few and few, getting fewer or less, younger people out. So, you know, these older people, they don't know how to take this. And I guess because I'm younger, you know, they call and tell me this stuff. I've got a guy behind me that's got a deer camera that he's caught pictures of. The guy next to me, all his hay bales are standing straight up. You know, they come out in a row, and you know, and they were all standing straight up the next morning.
Hey, Ricky, you mind if I interrupt for a quick second?
No, go ahead, James.
One of the things I remember you telling me, which was very interesting, was when that colonel called you. You said, "Stop flying over my house or stop harassing me."
Right.
And what was his response to that?
Well, his response was that that was his airspace, and you know.
And, his airspace, huh?
Yeah, I said, you know, I asked him, I said, well, could you at least quit flying over my airspace? And his response was that was his airspace, and he would do what he wanted to.
Ricky, are you glad that you saw this, or do you wish you never did?
You know, I don't know yet. You know, I tell you, there's times of...
Jury's still out, huh?
Yeah, it's been a long battle. It's, you know, it's... It's been a deal. I mean, it's I never asked for it, and I got to be honest with you. Growing up, I hear about these people seeing this stuff, and I never paid much attention. I always thought this were kind of nutty, but it happens to me. And you know, I'm the average guy. I grew up.
Would you have gone willingly aboard, Ricky, if bottom opened up and some beam hit you, and let's say you had a choice, would you have gone up there?
I'd probably shot, you know.
Yeah.
And no, there's no way. I'm just not that kind of a guy. And you know, it's been a deal. I actually thought about shooting the thing when I had my rifle, and you know, I was looking at it through my scope right off the bat, and you know, there's no way. I know that there was no way that a .223 would bring the thing. There's not even. This would be like shooting a 18-wheeler. You know, it just ain't going to do it no good. And this thing was, it was big. It was huge.
Ricky, had you not looked up, would you have known it was there?
No, I wouldn't have. If I hadn't looked up, you know, that's the deal. I was hunting, and James, you've been on my place.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get into the woods, you look down in there, and when you're deer hunting, the sun was going down. I was trying to get to this certain fence line to see the deer moving up the fence line. And you're looking down. And I got tangled up in some of them little briars. And I made too much noise. And the leaves that fell off the trees, and it was real crunchy in there. And most of the time I can sit in the deer stand and hear the deer coming through the leaves. And I knew they could hear me, so I thought, well, I'm going to slow down, take my time. And when I slowed down and eased up to let things quieten down, So I kind of stopped and looked up, and I was still walking gingerly, but it took me a couple steps, and I realized what my eyes had saw, and that's when I looked up, and I'd walked right underneath it. And
no health problems, Ricky? No radiation burns, nothing like that?
No, sir. No problems.
Okay.
Not that, yeah.
Ricky, describe when that thing took off. I just that is just so incredible.
Yeah, you know, I sit there and I couldn't, when I first saw it, my mind was racing, what in the heck, you know, what is this thing? And so I just slowed down, I started studying it. And I thought, well, it's all I can do. And I looked from left to right and forward, and I started bringing my head back, and I didn't feel comfortable tilting my head all the way back. And so I focused in on this cone, and I was looking at this cone, how wide, how deep is it? How high is this thing? And this cone started moving from left to right, and it stopped. And I thought, well, at this point, I can look all the way to my left and see the edge of it. And so I never took my eyes off of it. There's no way. It was covering everything I could see. And, you know, I looked to the left. I still couldn't see the edge of it. And I come back to the right, and, you know, I was sitting there, and I was looking at that cone again, and, this thing, it's like if you're going to drive a boat in the water, I guess. You know how the front of the boat got to turn to the right or left to go that way?
Right, right.
Well, I was watching this thing. I was studying that cone and looking at it. And this thing takes off. And for some, this is the weirdest part. I would have figured if something took off that the front would have lifted and took off. But it didn't. It remained flat. And it took off so fast that The only way I can describe it is if I would have blinked, I would have thought it disappeared. You know?
It would have been gone. And pretty quiet, right?
Never heard a sound. Never felt the wind blow. None of that, you know. No.
And Ricky, let me ask you this. Did it look more metallic than balloon-like?
More metallic than balloon-like?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some reports, for example, that what we may have are some huge dirigibles shaped triangularly. They may be balloons, for example, with special fans on them for movement. Of course, I don't know how they could go that fast. But, I mean, if you're looking at it, trying to remember it, did it look more metallic than a balloon?
It wasn't a balloon. It was a... It's like a piece of metal, a slab of metal. And, you know, I'm a machine for a living, and I weld and everything, and I understand how machines run. But if you was to take a piece of flat metal and put it over a press and press it down with some cones in it and then pick it back up and look at it from underneath, that's what it looked like.
Okay.
Yeah. When he says cones, because I had him, Ricky, I had you explain this to me really carefully on a number of occasions. You take an ice cream cone and you invert it.
Right.
And so the belly of the craft actually has these inverted cones going up and to a point.
Yes, sir.
On the belly of the craft.
So. How many of those cones?
It was in a grid pattern, too. You know, the cones were in a grid pattern.
Huh.
They were about, you know, I'm guessing 30 to 40 foot apart.
James, what the heck would that be for?
I've been thinking about that. You know, it's so funny because it doesn't disturb the air because you'd think it was for... Baffling. I just don't know. I mean, it's not aesthetics, that's for sure. It
no.
has to have something to do with either the propulsion or the way it moves through the air. I mean,
yeah,
why else would it do that?
Yeah, there's a reason for it, no doubt. And Ricky, could it have been carbon fibers by any chance?
The
structure?
I don't think so. You know, I don't know. Could have been, you know.
Something light.
Yeah, it was. I never seen this, you know, before. It's like a, you know, the gray, old barn tin, the old style barn tin turns
yep.
gray.
Yeah.
Some people in Texas know the gray on a mesquite tree. It was that color, and you know, and it appeared to be to me what I know is metal. You know.
And no insignia, no labeling, no words, no letters.
No, sir. Nothing.
Hey, Ricky, did that military guy tell you not to talk about this thing?
Yes, sir, he did.
How did he say it? What did he say?
You know, basically he said, you know, when we had that heated discussion, you know, he asked me not to say anything. He told me if I wouldn't, you know, go around saying what I saw, then he would ease off on the helicopters. And I said, well, okay, you know, half-heartedly. And that's hard for me to do. But, and I tell you what, I haven't had a helicopter fly over.
You know, James, if this happens to be a military piece of equipment, a military craft, I could also understand the military trying to harass somebody like Ricky to get them to be quiet. Well, don't you? Can't you?
You know, sure. I mean, and if it is military, boy, I tell you, I wish that technology was in the public domain because we could use it right about now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as Richard C. Hoagland would say, it's probably being used in some kind of black ops program.
I mean, with Jet A fuel, the prices of fuel these days, it doesn't sound like it's getting around on that Jet A fuel.
Hey, Ricky, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you letting me be here.
Yeah, that's the eyewitness that Linda Moulton Howe was talking about many months ago. And it's an incredible story, James Fox, isn't
it? Unbelievable. I mean, I tell you, when I met with him, I've met with a lot of witnesses from all over the world, and he's just got a authenticity and pureness about him that I really, you know, like I said, I mean, he told us a very detailed account, me and the whole camera crew, when we were in Stephenville in January, but he wasn't willing to do it on the record. And I said, look, if you ever want to come forward, here's my number. Please call me. And lo and behold, a couple months later,
here he is.
Just met with him in Texas.
Hey, James, when we come back, I want to get your reaction to this alien video they're going to apparently show in Denver on Friday, just to get your take on what the heck you think this might be. James Fox, our guest, later on, next hour, Richard Dolan joins James as we talk in this special report about UFOs right here on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, UFO researcher Richard Dolan joins us along with James Fox. But when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with James Fox. By the way, his website, outoftheblue.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Here he is, James Fox, with us. James, have you been following this story of Jeff Peckman, who wants the city of Denver to have an extraterrestrial commission to get ready for a visitation?
Yeah, he needs, I think, 4,000 signatures to get it on the
ballot. Yeah.
I got CNN contacted me about this whole thing, and they said, what do you think about this? And I said, well, you know, it kind of, I mean, I don't know, I haven't seen it, but it kind of reminds me of the Santilli film that came out, the alien autopsy thing. You remember, and I don't know if the, you know, one has to think back to extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and at the very least, I would hope that whoever shot this would come forward, because remember when Santilli came out with that alien autopsy footage, I was very suspicious when I found that the guy who took it wouldn't come forward.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know what I mean? It just it didn't.
And the producer subsequently told me he knew it wasn't real.
Oh, he did?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. And then they wanted to go back to Fox with a special on just what they think had happened. And I guess what they were trying to say was the film wasn't real, but it was a recreation of what they saw that was real.
Oh, really?
And so that didn't work.
Hey, you know, speaking of film footage, you remember when we were on Larry King with Buzz Aldrin?
Yes.
And he was talking about that sighting. Well, a couple of months ago, I put out a statement to any military or government officials with sort of experienced unambiguous UFO cases to, you know, get in touch with us for continue the progression of the film. And I get a 16-millimeter film roll sent to me that was taken on Apollo 11. It's a copy of whatever was taken. And I take it in, and of course, I have it transferred digitally. And it shows, there's no audio, but it's clearly Apollo 11. And I talked to Buzz about this, I think in 1999 or 2000 when I was supposed to meet with him in the south of France. It clearly shows for about 4 seconds what appears to me to be a disc, a saucer-shaped disc. And I don't know if they're leaving the moon or if they're, you know, coming or going. But it's out the window of the capsule, and it was shot by Buzz Aldrin. Very interesting, right? Because you remember, I remember him telling me, confirming this story for me quite some time ago, and then, of course, he sort of recanted.
He recanted. Yeah, he denied it, and he was telling me in the green room after they slapped makeup on us that, you know, he didn't see anything.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember, you know, he had me, I don't know if I've told you the story or not, but I actually, through his sister and through I worked on a film, The Legend of Obi Taggart, with Andy, was it Rooney, and one of the, think of the name of the other person. But in any case, they had actually met with him, and they told him, he had told him about this encounter they had on the way to the moon. And long story short, after about 6 years, I finally got him to agree to an interview, and he said, well, I'll be in the south of France. So I borrowed all this money, got a camera crew together, I flew to the south of France, and he kept putting it off, and on the day five, he said, well, meet me in my hotel lobby, and this is Monte Carlo. It's costing me like $500 a day.
Oh, my God,
just
yeah.
Just to stay there. So I'm like, let's do this thing, you know.
Hey, I would have called Prince Albert for you, gotten you a discount.
And so on day five, you know, he said, well, meet me in the hotel lobby and don't have the cameras rolling. I said, okay. And so I'm sitting down waiting. I'm having a cup of coffee, and I'm waiting for him in the hotel lobby, and I get the concierge comes up and said, Mr. Fox, yeah. Got a phone call. It's Buzz Aldrin. He's in his room. He said, I can't do it.
No.
I promise you. He said, I can't do it. I said, well, why not? I mean, I flew over to south of France. I've been waiting here for 5 days. He said, Paul Allen just invested in SETI. And SETI got, I swear to you, this is the honest God truth, exactly how it happened. He said, SETI, he invested money in SETI. He got labeled a UFO nut. And he did not want to jeopardize his initiative of trying to develop a rocket. He was trying to get funding from Congress to put civilians into outer space. And he said, I don't want to jeopardize that initiative, and sorry. And he pulled the carpet out from under me. Boom, end of story.
Unbelievable.
I promise you this is exactly the truth. I met with his sister, who lives in my neck of the woods. I won't mention her name, but she does live right around me, and I've met with her on a number of occasions. And he shared this story, intimate details, of obviously it's his sister. And she called me the other day, and she said, you know, I don't know. She said, I saw that Larry King show. I don't know. I think someone's gotten to him because he won't even talk about it anymore. So I don't know. I've got this footage now. I don't know what to do with it because there's no audio in the capsule. So you don't know what the astronauts are saying, but they're clearly filming it. And, you know, I can't prove anything, but it, I mean, it clearly looks like a disc with light reflecting off of it. It's not sitting on the surface of the moon. It's away from the moon. It's in the air.
Did you show any of that at the National Press Club?
I did not. I got this after the National Press Club.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what to do with it. If anybody out there is listening has any kind of idea or any leads about this, I don't want to put it in the film without cooperative testimony from at least one of the Apollo astronauts.
No, exactly.
I'm trying to get a hold of Buzz right now to have a meeting with him. He's in Los Angeles, but we'll see what happens. Who knows?
You should show it to Mitchell. At least Edgar would tell you what he thinks it is.
That's a good idea. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, because he's a straight shooter.
He is a straight shooter. And he told me he didn't know of any sightings that he knew of that occurred in space, but, you know.
James, since you and I last talked, lots of things have been going on. The Brits have released their classified UFO files. The French continue to do what they do. Lots have been going on. You had a chance to meet with the French equivalent of NASA, the head of that, right?
Yes, Jacques Patinet.
Patinet. And we've got a little link up that you gave us on the coasttocoastam.com website. What was that gathering all about?
It was amazing. You know, one of the shows we did in November with Larry King, we tried to get Jacques Patinet to do a satellite feed from Paris because obviously, you know, the French had just released their files. I think like 1,600 cases that were reviewed, out of which I think it's roughly 28% remain unexplained. Some of them are quite extraordinary. And we were unsuccessful at pinning him down. But I think after the National Press Club event, because we invited so many members of the French, I mean, we had Claude Power and astrophysicist Jean-Claude Louis, we had Debock. And so they came back to France, and I think they really touted Leslie Kane and I's effort. And it was very, you know, credible. But in any case, I suddenly got access to these people. I got access to Letty, General Letty, the Air Force, who spearheaded the Cometa report, which is incredible. And I got access. We got access to Patinet, which was incredible. I mean, they're not retired. They're current. It was amazing. You know, I remember asking him about, you know, if you could, what was his personal opinion on a lot of these cases, and he said, well, obviously, as mine is, you know, a lot of them can and have been explained away in sort of down-to-earth conventional terms, but there's this core percent that he believes will, you know, probably lead to a very strong possibility of an extraterrestrial presence, which is amazing for someone in his position to say this.
True.
And and then I said, well, gosh, you know, the American government hasn't been very forthcoming. What would you say to the American government, you know? And he sort of gets a bit standoffish, and he puts his hands in the air, and he kind of, oh, you know, I don't want to mess around with America. But, you know, now that you mention it, he said, with a little reluctance, he said, you know, to the American government, I would say, don't be afraid to tell the public the truth. And I'm translating from French, but that's in essence what he said. And it's remarkable. And, you know, and since then, obviously, England is, and he told me England was going to be releasing files. And they haven't released everything. England's just, you know, they're progressively releasing stuff.
They're keeping the good stuff, aren't they?
They're probably keeping the really good stuff. Isn't that usually what happens?
Did you like Jacques Patinet?
Oh, my gosh. He was the most affable guy. Yeah. He was amazing. He was warm. We had some coffee. We talked a little bit about you know, what we were going to discuss on camera. We went and had coffee with Yves Ciard. Yves Ciard was chairman of JPL now, and we sort of, we got along very well. I mean, he was a very, very friendly, open person. And like I said, I really think that the National Press Club event, I mean, people ask me quite often, like, well, you know, what was accomplished by doing that event? And I think more than anything else, It's given Leslie and I access, unprecedented access to military and government officials from around the world because they communicate with each other.
Well, we need more government officials to begin to disclose, like Paul Hellyer, the former defense minister of Canada, and what the Brits are doing. We need more of that to happen.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And one of the things I want to mention quickly is, you know, Leslie Kane, and this was her idea, with the Coalition for Freedom of Information. She said, well, you know, I want to spearhead this initiative. while we've got all these amazing government and military officials in one spot. It's a two-page document basically asking for it's been signed by nine countries, including five generals, and it's only including military and government officials. I think she's got some pilots on there who've had direct involvement with UFOs. Simonton has signed it, but asking for an international exchange of information. In other words, a reopening sort of UFO investigations. And I really think that's gonna get some traction, because we've got some, and tell me if I'm rambling here, but we've got some pretty good ideas for unrolling this rolling this new film out.
And that is Beyond the Blue. That's your working title.
It's a working title, yeah. I'm not happy with that title right now. If anyone has any ideas, let me know. I don't want flying saucer or UFO or alien in the title. I want it to be very kind of vague in that respect.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Isn't that one Taken?
Yeah. You know, speaking of France, what happened last year on that flight between France and the Channel Islands?
I went to the Channel Islands, and we documented that case. We actually interviewed the pilot, Ray Bowyer. And I flew in a couple of his passengers, and I also got to meet briefly with, you know, it's so frustrating because it was seen by a couple of different pilots, and one of them was Ray Bowyer, who's with Aranyi Airlines, the Channel Islands, who's flying back from France to England, and they witnessed this. I mean, he flew towards this thing for like 12 minutes, possibly longer, and then there were two disc-like objects right off in front of him, and he was observing them with binoculars for about, like I said, about 12 minutes. And he said he got uncomfortably close to them, that they were so huge, he estimated them to be roughly a mile across, and diverted, because he said he was quite happy to put the, I'll quote him here, to land the plane and have a cup of tea. And the witness, I interviewed the witnesses who'd seen it, but I kind of delayed the whole trip by a week, and I had to kind of stand around in Paris. I should be so lucky, but we had to wait in Paris, which was rather expensive with a whole camera crew, an extra week, because the other pilot that witnessed this with Blue, I think it was Blue Island Air, was tangled up in Germany and was going to be back a week later. But by the time I got to the Channel Islands, word got out that we were coming, and the airline company, his airline company, asked him if he enjoyed his job not to talk with us.
See, they threaten you that way.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we met with him briefly in a off the record, and I kind of ambushed him a little bit with a camera coming out of a parking lot and got a very brief statement from him, but unfortunately we didn't get it on camera. But we did get it on camera with Ray Bowyer. We met, spent some time with the community in the Channel Islands, in Guernsey. And like I said, we met with a couple of the passengers that conferred with us, and there's some analysis taking place with the radar right now.
Well, you have been doing this for a long time now. What drives you, James Fox? What pushes you?
I would say, what they say, it's what you love is going to kill you. I really want to clearly establish on a global level in mainstream media that the phenomenon is real and that it is happening worldwide. And I think that if I could maintain a fairly conservative position and just deal with high-ranking military and government officials and don't make any claims that I can't back up, not to say that my personal viewpoints don't exceed what the film talks about, because I get castigated a lot in the UFO community because they say, oh, you need to talk about them. I'm not trying to preach to the choir here. I'm trying to penetrate a much larger audience, a much more mainstream audience, so we can really get this information out there. So I do tend to be very rather conservative publicly. I want to make a movie that gets theatrical release. We've got a great team of people behind us right now. I've been working night and day, 24/7 on this. I think we have a really good chance at it. We've got a really great crew. We've got an editor consultant who worked on Apocalypse Now, who's been helping us. We've got a great agent. We've got a lot of media and stuff behind us. I just have to produce a good movie.
Well, you will. You will. You're hard dedicated. Hey, what did you think? Give me your honest opinion of what you thought of Ricky Searles.
I think Ricky is one of the most impressive eyewitness testimonies I've ever heard. I'd put him right up there at the top 2%. just because like I said, I mean, he didn't want to go on record at all with us. And you know, when you spend time with the guy, you know, he's your average Joe, and he
down to earth guy.
He never asked for this, never wanted it. He turned down everyone. Seeing it, he was bombarded by everyone for months, and he turned them all down categorically. I managed to meet him. Very fortunate to have met him through some people that, you know, I did that Larry King appearance the night before I ended up in Stephenville, and that kind of helped integrate me into the local scene there. And so, like I said, I met him, and his story off the record was just, it was amazing. And he took me to the exact location, and Ricky was just at a loss for words to describe the metal and, you know, the fact that it didn't make any noise and the speed in which it took off. You know, and I hear these stories time and time again. You know, and the funny thing about it was we were interviewing a series of witnesses in Phoenix when I got the phone call that this thing had been sighted in Texas.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So, you know, you hear these stories about, you know, silent, it doesn't disturb the air, it doesn't make any noise. And Ricky actually told me that he felt that an airplane could have landed on this thing. That's how big it was.
Gosh. Well, you know, I'm at odds with myself, James, because part of me says this is a black ops government program. We've got this technology. Maybe we reversed engineered it from some crashed saucer. Who knows? And then the other part of me says, no, it's extraterrestrial. It's coming from another planet, and they're here, and they monitor us. And I keep wrestling with myself back and forth about these objects. I mean, I believe we've been visited before. I believe we may have been seated. But in this particular case, I keep fighting with myself on this.
Well, you know, it's interesting that one would fly a black op project over a community. I mean, not to say that it's impossible. I mean, I have to consider all options, too, you know. But one of the things that I talked to Jacques Patinet about, what were some of the more impressive cases that he looked into? And he talks about, and it's so funny, of a man of his stature and credibility, and he's so articulate, and, you know, he talks about beings. You know, you're sitting there listening to this guy talk about beings. You know, I'm going, beans? Did you just say beans? You talking about what? Beans? You know, and that sort of takes you right over to the other side. It's like, okay, well, we can't, you know, clearly make the distinction here between something that's terrestrial and something that's obviously, you know, not. And you hear those stories, and I have a hard time with it too, George. But I think until someone can come forward and give us a conventional explanation to these craft that, you know, up to a mile across, they can accelerate from zero to infinity in the blink of an eye. Don't disturb the air. Don't make a sonic boom. And why are military jets chasing it?
Well, that's a good point. If it's ours, why are they chasing it?
You know, and why, if they're going to fly it over to a populated area, why would they harass witnesses that saw it? And, you know, they don't harass people that saw the lights. And that's another thing is that another similar pattern that I noticed in Texas, as in Phoenix, is that there seem to be these orbs. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of you guys out there had seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Spielberg's piece. But they're the orbs that seem to kind of, they're scouter orbs or something. They seem to be seen at the same time there's a large craft.
Yes,
witness.
Good point.
And that was the same case in Texas. I interviewed the constable, you know, Leroy Gayton, who's a police officer there. And he talks about these orbs, and he said, you know, these military jets were chasing after these orbs.
And well, James, stick around. We're going to have Richard Dolan join us next hour, but I'd like you to stay with us for the hour and join in on the conversation. Richard will be with us also in the final hour to take your phone calls on this special UFO night. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And joining us next, Richard Dolan, along with James Fox. Richard, of course, is a very special UFO investigator, and he published a 500-page study called UFOs in the National Security State. We'll be back with Richard and James in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Richard Dolan, he holds a BA degree from Alfred University, an MA from the University of Rochester, and as I mentioned, in 2000, He published a 500-page study, UFOs in the National Security State, first volume of a two-part historical narrative of the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon, including records of more than 50 military bases relating to just a number of violations of sensitive airspace by unknown objects, demonstrating that the U.S. military has taken the topic of UFOs seriously, even though they don't publicly admit it to us. Here he is, along with James Fox, Richard Dolan. Richard, my friend, how are you?
Hello, George. Thank you for having me on tonight.
Oh,
hello, James.
Hey, Richard. I got a little bone to pick with you.
Oh, good.
I'm so anal about these things, but you never sent me the parking ticket that I was supposed to pay when we met in New York last month.
Oh, now tell me about this, Mr. Fox. What parking ticket?
I interviewed Richard. We met up in a park in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, parking's like in Manhattan.
Oh, God.
Richard got a parking ticket during my interview. I said, Richard, I'll pay for it, I promise.
God almighty.
Richard, you never said it to me. I told you I'd pay for it.
Yeah, I was driving all over Manhattan. I couldn't find a thing. Found a spot that I thought looked good to me. I don't know. Go meet with James. We have this really cool interview. And I come back and there's this big old parking ticket on my car. So James was really nice. He said, oh, yeah, just let me have it. Well, I just got the ticket, actually, James. So I tell you what, I'll send it to you.
I'm gonna force both of you now to hear my story about
thank you.
Parking.
That was very nice of you.
And things. And a woman goes into a New York bank, and she's got outside her Rolls Royce, and she says to the banker, and it's a $275,000 car, and she said, "Gosh, I'd like to borrow $5,000, please. And I'd like to put my Rolls Royce up as collateral, and I'm going to be gone for 30 days, so I'll come back and I'll pay the interest and I'll pay the $5,000. And the banker looked at her and goes, sure, this is a secure loan. So he cuts the deal. She goes away for 30 days. She comes back, writes a check for the $5,000 and a little bit of interest. And, you know, as she's ready to leave, the banker's there with his buddy, another banker, and they're both laughing at her. And they said, you know what, I've got to tell you, you may be one of the dumbest ladies I've ever met. I mean, you put up a $275,000 Rolls Royce to borrow a measly $5,000 for 30 days. Are you crazy? And she said, do you know how much parking costs here in New York?
My 91 Saturn was very similar to that.
That's great. About half a million, I think.
Anyways, Richard Dolan, welcome aboard. You're going to be with me for 2 hours. We've got James for this hour.
Looking forward to it.
What is new, Mr. Dolan?
Well, gosh, I'm every time I talk with you, I say the same thing. I'm almost done with the next book, George. I'm really working on it.
You will get it. Look, the first one was 500 pages, so
yeah.
These things take time.
Well, here's the new twist, though. You know, for many years, I've told people that I'm working on a two-volume historical study of the UFO phenomenon. It's three volumes now. This is the latest, and it really will be three. I've been really working through the amount of data that I've been using and working with, and it's too vast. So volume two will be done this year. I'm really quite confident in saying that. It will take the story of the UFO cover-up from 1973 to 1991. It's a very, very good cutoff year for a lot of reasons. I'll be happy to go over that with you sometime.
Sure.
Volume 3, the research for which is completely done right now, I've got all of that finished, that will cover 1991 to the present day. And I really expect that Volume 3 will be a fairly quick book to write. I mean, as I say, the research is all done. So Volume 2 this year, Volume 3 a year or two after that, to get all the narrative out, and it'll be a three-volume, approximately, God, I'm sorry to do this to people, but about 1,500 pages of history to read.
Oh, but it's incredible history. And you know, Richard, every time I meet you at an event or at a conference, you have got, and I've got to compliment you on this, you have got such a conviction of doing what you're doing. I mean, yes, you have fun and you have a good time. You've got a lovely wife and life is good. But I mean, you are darn serious about this subject. And I can see it on your face when I meet you
all the
time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and maybe one day, you know, James Fox, Richard Dolan, Stanton Friedman, and so many people have devoted their lives and careers to this. Stephen Bassett will one day wake up and find out that their hard work, your hard work, has been rewarded with the answers that we're looking for.
Doesn't it seem like there's a movement happening right now, an international movement that's kind of happening? I mean, I really feel, I mean, I've only been in it, what, 15 years, but I really feel like there's a growing transparency happening within governments. I mean, look what just happened in the last couple of years.
I think that the entire globe is moving so fast in the direction of change in a variety of ways. I mean, technologically, socially, economically, politically, culturally, we're moving so fast that I think it's created a very unstable situation, and one in which governments, among other groups, are scrambling. This is not like the 1960s, and it's not like the 1860s, and it's not like prior millennia, where things moved along a lot more slowly. I have believed for some time that actual disclosure on UFOs is going to happen. It is a train that cannot be stopped. And the real question is not when it's going to happen or if it's going to happen, but are we really going to be ready for it when it happens? Because it's coming.
Richard, doesn't it kind of seem like it's trickling out, sort of, this is just my personal opinion here, but it seems like it's trickling out to sort of prepare people slowly. I remember, I think it was the evening before the National Press Club event, we did a Larry King show, and we had a number of high-ranking military and government officials on the set, and the commercial breaks, and Larry would look over and he'd say, God, this is real, isn't it? This is real.
Wow.
And they'd go, yeah, I'm afraid.
Yeah, Larry, it is. Yeah.
This is true, you know, and he just had this look like, God, I've been duped kind of look on his face, you know?
Really? Wow.
I promise you, yeah, I'll never forget it. And a lot of the people, I won't mention, you know, names at CNN, but they're, you know, they passed around out of the blue. I mean, everybody watched it in CNN and all people in New York and D.C. and L.A. offices, and they all are like, scratching their heads going, God, how could we have missed this story?
Well, it's going, I think about this a lot as well, James, and when this happened, what you find is you talk to people in high-level media positions who are, they don't do the UFO topic at all, but you spend 5-10 minutes with them, if one-on-one and they listen, they're receptive, they really are. But the problem is there's so many people out there who have really not given this much thought that it's just not part of their worldview. And when it comes, it cannot but be a very great shock for them. My God, the implication, religious,
even the Vatican. Remember the Vatican, Richard, just a few weeks ago came out and said, you know what, the belief in extraterrestrial life won't negate God. And, you know, we basically accept the fact that if they're out there, it's okay.
Yeah,
I think that was pretty dramatic.
Absolutely, yes. I agree totally. I mean, look, the Vatican is an institution that's 2,000 years old, for God's sake. So they're talking about this for the first time. This, you know, 500 years ago, a fellow named Giordano Bruno was executed for talking
yeah.
about life on other worlds. So for the Vatican to say this, it's very important. And it's really not too many steps away from recognizing that ETs might be here.
You guys look at someone like Fife Symington, who's been working closely with me and Leslie on this.
Former governor of Arizona.
Governor of Arizona. But remember, he's good friends with Bill Clinton. He saved him from drowning in an accident in college. He was pardoned by Bill Clinton. He's in touch with the Bush administration. I think he came into office when Bush Sr. was president.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, he signed on to this initiative, we're putting together, it was his idea, we're putting together a book based on the National Press Club event. He's getting behind that. And he's really, really pushing in our corner. And he's got unprecedented access.
It's quite significant. Here's the one thing that cannot be denied, though. We keep talking about there's pressures for pushing this open. There are, but there are still very tremendous pressures for keeping it closed. Because after all, as far as the three of us are concerned, and probably everybody who's listening, the Fife Symington story should be a major story. I mean, it should be covered right now on all the major networks. Here's this former governor who does a complete turnaround on the Phoenix lights and,
yep.
and
ridiculed the lights when it happened
yep.
in 97.
Exactly.
It did get some pretty amazing coverage. I remember when it happened because Fife basically turned his phone off and he said, deal with James, because he's the one that got me to come forward. And I was inundated for weeks, every news organization in America that I'd ever heard of.
You got him on Coast to Coast, James, yeah. if I remember.
Yeah, okay. I did, yeah. I got him to come on Coast to Coast.
And we need follow-up from the mainstream media. I'm talking NBC, ABC.
We were on Nightline and Dateline yeah. and Today Show and Good yeah. Morning America and
excellent.
And Larry excellent. King and
but,
I mean,
but I think what Richard's saying, James, is it's gone. It's
yeah,
over.
Yeah, true.
You know,
right.
you
yeah.
know Anna Nicole dies dies and it goes on forever. Britney
right.
Spears
really
has her
point.
Problems.
Right.
It's
good
forever.
What gives it staying power? Good point. And what does?
This is important, and it gets dropped into the black hole, and you never hear about it again.
Well,
and
Richard,
mainstream media, they just act as though people like us, this is our hobby.
Well,
you know, Richard, one little thing.
So sorry, I'll let you guys continue. I was just going to mention an idea that I had to roll out this movie, but carry on. We can pick up on that later.
Absolutely. When we met each other back in D.C. At the Stephen Bassett's X conference. Your major thrust was the confrontational encounters between the military and
yes,
UFOs.
That's right.
How prevalent is this problem?
It goes right back to the beginning, George. And I mention this because, one of the big things that Steve likes to talk about at his conferences is the idea of disclosure. I think it's a great idea. But if we have disclosure about the ET reality, one thing that we're going to have to factor into this is the fact that our military has not had a particularly positive relationship with some of these objects. They're just based, if nothing else, on factual documentation and very, very good eyewitness accounts of our jets chasing these things. These objects, whoever they belong to, have been violating sensitive airspace for many, many years, and the United States military and other militaries have been scrambling jets constantly to go after them. So that tells me that there's some trouble in paradise here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever else is going on, whether these are we consider them good or evil or whatever, there's an adversarial relationship to some degree. And when that comes out as an open disclosure, I don't believe it's going to be all, well, they're the wonderful Space Brothers who are here to take us to the next plane of existence, I think.
As David Jacobs would say.
Well, right. Jacobs would agree that there's some trouble in paradise.
Right.
His argument is that they're here, they're creating a hybrid species, and they're up to something. It's my belief also that there are a number of ET species that are here, and that at least one of them is creating a hybrid species that looks very much like us. And that sounds creepy, but I think that the research literature by people like Dave Jacobs, Bud Hopkins, and several others indicates that there could be what's called a transgenic species that is here, and these are individuals that look like human but have much, much more than human capabilities.
What's the purpose, Richard, if they're doing this?
To do work for them here, to meld in with our society.
To take over our society?
Well, I don't know about taking over, but to fit in, to work, to facilitate abduction experiences. Certainly that's what it looks like in Bud Hopkins' research. So, think of it this way. If we were an alien species on another world and we were observing the dominant technological species on some planet and we didn't look like them, but we wanted to interact with them to some degree, we might terrify them by showing them the way we actually look. So
we might
want to create a species that looks just like them to work with them for a variety of purposes. And I think this is exactly what at least one ET species has done. I think they've created a transgenic species. They've done it through abductions, through DNA manipulation. And so if that is true, that's yet another facet of what disclosure would have to entail.
That's the, I think probably one would initially start off with dipping a toe in the water and sort of establishing the fact that it's a physical phenomenon, obviously, under intelligent control.
I'm with you, James.
But, Richard, I have to ask you, are you going to this? There's a MUFON symposium, I guess it's happening July 24th, 27th in California.
Actually, I won't be at that one. I've spoken at the last several MUFONs, and I just came back from California a week ago, but I won't be at that one.
Oh, okay, because there's a good chance there's going to be a national, possibly a CNN. I'm trying to organize, because there's going to be so many people in one spot. I mean, DeBrower's coming out, General DeBrower, Nick Pope, Anthony Choi from Peru.
You've got CNN's ear, James. I'll tell you that.
Isn't it amazing? I just have to pinch myself because it's a golden opportunity because we could set up a satellite dish from this spot, and I was kind of hoping, Richard, that you'd be there for that. We could set a satellite up there, and we can get them all in one place.
Well, I mean, maybe I can get myself out there. The thing with disclosure, I agree with you, James, 100%, that how this is presented is it's absolutely critical to be as conservative as possible, to simply talk about what can be easily provable to a very skeptical mainstream media, and it's necessary not to go beyond that.
As soon as we start talking about aliens, they just shut us down.
That's right. But the thing is this, though, at a certain point when one researches into this field and you start looking at who are these people behind the UFOs.
Right. Which is the natural state of progression, right?
And it's necessary once let's say the president of the United States or some other important person, like UN chief, I don't know, says to the world, it looks like extraterrestrials are here and that the UFO phenomenon is legitimate. Well, you can't just then pack it all in and go on vacation. There's many, many questions.
Who are they? Where do they come from?
Yeah, there's a lot of follow-up there.
And it's a legitimate part of UFO research to try to figure out, at least to what extent possible, what is the nature of these other beings. In my own research, I have avoided dealing with this for a very, very long time. In fact, I was almost afraid to get into it because I just felt, as you're indicating, James, that it's really not a very easily defensible position publicly when you're dealing with a very skeptical world. But I think in the last year or two, I've really been trying to grapple with this a little more. I just feel that enough is enough. And that doesn't mean that I'm trying to put myself out completely on a limb here. But I think it's certainly fair to speculate, even privately, what we might be dealing with.
I say things, obviously, privately that I would never say publicly because I can't prove it, you know. This whole position I've been taking, Leslie's been taking, seems to be gaining some traction, you know. And I think more people are inclined, people that really have a lot of gravitas, to come on board with us because they know we take this very conservative position. But I completely respect and appreciate the work of people like Bud Hopkins and a number of others, Dave Jacobs that you'd mentioned. I think it's very important. But obviously, you know, I keep going back to this very conservative position that I feel it necessary certainly to penetrate a much larger audience.
I agree with you. May I add that you're...
Hold it, Richard, because we'll take this quick break and we'll come back with Richard Dolan, James Fox. We'll talk a little bit about his new film, Beyond the Blue. And the next hour, Richard will stick around with us and take your phone calls. Well, Reuters is reporting a very large explosion over some of the islands in Vietnam, and it's called, listen to this, an unidentified flying object exploded. So they just don't know what it is. But it apparently exploded in midair over a southern Vietnamese island, according to their state media. And it was a day after Cambodia's Air Force retracted a report of a mysterious plane crash. Retracted a report. Now, they have found some metal, some large pieces of metal near the coastline. And we'll just try to keep our eyes on this story as it begins to unfold. But at the moment, no one is reporting claims of any missing major airline or so a plane. So it's a strange story as well. We'll be back in a moment. Richard Dolan, James Fox on Coast to Coast AM. James, right before we get into Beyond the Blue, the working title for your new film, what did you think of that story in Vietnam?
That's amazing. Did you hear that story on the surface of Mars today?
Now, what was that one?
Well, a friend of mine T-voted for me, but he said that they captured an anomalous object reflecting light, metallic object on the surface of Mars. And I said, are you kidding me? He said, no, I T-boated it. It's happening right now.
All right, I'll check on it. We've got to get a hold of that one. Wow. Okay. Hey, Beyond the Blue, tell us, what's it going to consist of?
We basically took, obviously, all the cases from the National Press Club event, we thoroughly documented, because it's unprecedented to have that level of, you know, military and government officials in one spot. So we documented that over a four-day period. We did extensive interviews with everyone. And we're going to touch on some cases more heavily than others. But it's not going to be someone standing at a podium. We actually go sort of back in time. We do recreations. We interview additional witnesses. Phoenix is amazing. And we went back and we interviewed witnesses that stood directly under this thing, entire families that were outside and take 5 minutes to sort of pass overhead. And if I could, if there's anyone listening out there, one of the things, the elements we're missing, we need a witness at Luke Air Force Base. And I met someone out there one time about 8 years ago, March 13th, 1997, that was at Luke Air Force Base. If there's anyone out there listening, if you don't mind me saying this, please get in touch with us, because we'd love to get you, you know, and obviously any video footage of that craft that night would be fantastic.
Do they get a hold of you, James, through your website?
Yes. And, any photographs in Stephenville, Texas, we're covering that case quite extensively. Obviously, you know, the O'Hare case. I mean, I've gotten in touch with witnesses at O'Hare, and we were offering $10,000 per witness to come forward that was at United Airlines, because we figured that would cover the legal fees. They won't do it. I mean, they talked to me off the record. They said, no, we'll lose our jobs.
Oh, my gosh.
And there were two photographs taken. It was really frustrating. I've talked to one of the pilots and one of the mechanics, United Airlines. There were two photographs taken, and we cannot get our hands on those. We offered money for those as well.
And the FAA said it was what? Some kind of weather anomaly? Yeah.
A whole bunched cloud. I mean,
a donut cloud, right?
Has anybody actually heard the FAA tapes?
I have not.
Okay, we've got them in the movie. They're great. And I've got them confirmed.
Really?
Oh,
wow.
Are you kidding me? You got to hear this stuff, you guys. It's
James, what are you holding back on me for?
Well, no, I'm coming out. They're coming out with the movie in a couple months' time. But these are they're live while it's happening. You know, this woman's saying, I'm not hallucinating, I'm not drunk, and I'm not crazy. There's a disc hovering over Terminal 17, United Airlines, right now. And it's being photographed and seen, and the guy's going, you mean a Frisbee?
Yeah,
going,
yeah.
And this goes on for 5 or 10 minutes.
Wow, James, this film has some real potential to make some breakthroughs.
Oh, my gosh, you know, we hired Richard Hall to, I said, look, find me the best photographic video and film evidence that exists today. And he spent a month putting this amazing report together.
Richard Hall is probably one of the most senior, respected UFO researchers in the world.
Yeah.
He knows his stuff.
Yep.
So he put together a list, and then, of course, Leslie Kane has been spending painstakingly contacting each and every person that owns or is in possession of this stuff. It's all going to be, you know, thoroughly vetted material. And that's why another reason why I'm kind of putting this out there to anyone listening, if they have really good, unambiguous footage, not little lobs of light, which very well might be something very interesting, but we need it very unambiguous. Points of reference is always preferable. That's the kind of stuff we're doing. We're trying to put together the best of the best.
Richard got one of the most perplexing phone calls during my open lines a few months ago. Someone called in and said, George, if the UFOs want to be secret, because they're obviously not landing on the White House lawn, why do they have lights? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, there's all of these perplexing questions. I think the lights in some cases might be an effect of power generation of their craft itself.
They probably can't help it.
It might be like a plasma. I spoke with one very, very technically, scientifically knowledgeable researcher who's looked into this, and his belief is that in many cases, what look like windows on the craft, lighted windows, are in fact the result of a plasma generation field.
I talked to a fighter pilot in France who explained that exact thing to me.
Oh, really?
It was blinding light coming out of what looks like windows. But let me say something really quickly, you guys. I got a phone call from this guy, and I'm gonna say his name, Richard Clark. He's
the former. That Chuck, Richard
so
Clark?
Sorry, Chuck Clark. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Richard Clark was with the...
He was living out of Rachel, Nevada in the 90s, and even in 2000 up to 2003, 2004. He called me one time. He said, James, you got to see what I've got. I said, what is it? He said, I've got some footage that's going to knock your socks off. I said, really? And he said, you know, that good? He said, trust me, this is as good as it gets. So I dropped everything, got in my car, and I drove straight to Rachel, Nevada, and I get to this guy's place. And he puts this thing on for me, and it's like, and I promise you I saw this with my own eyes. It's two tourists from Los Angeles on a road trip, and it's the quintessential road trip. You know, they're getting out, and they're goofing off by the extraterrestrial sign, and they're out spinning donuts in the parking lot, you know, the dirt parking lot in that desert, and they're futzing around at the alien, the little alien. And then the next thing you see is the inside, it's dusk. It's still light out, it's dusk. The inside of the car, and they're arguing back and forth, and you see this very ominous light source from directly above them that looks like the source itself is kind of wobbling because the shadows are eerily kind of moving on the inside of the car, but quiet. You can hear a pin drop. Mm-hmm. And the little there's a guy's about 30, and the other kid's about 18, and the 18-year-old's got the camera, and he said, I'm going outside to film it. And the guy said, no, you're not. And they're arguing back and forth. And the guy says, yes, I am, and he opens the door. And the camera pans, the camera's rolling the whole time. The camera pans from the ground directly up. You can see, you know, the plants and stuff on the desert floor, you know, the desert. And then it goes up, a little bit of sky. And then all of a sudden, taking up about a third of the viewfinder, a third of the television set, is this disc. This perfect disc. I promise you guys, I saw this with my own eyes. And it's, speaking of glowing, it's like everything on it was glowing. There's no source of light. It's like the molecules of this thing were glowing, this orangey-yellow color.
So, James, you're a filmmaker. I mean, what do you think about the likelihood that this could have been a hoax for your sake? I mean, I'm assuming you
it's
don't
believe it. It's the most impressive footage I've ever seen because there are points of reference. There are these two guys arguing, you know, they're arguing back and forth. You could clearly hear the fear in their voices. The camera pans, one steady pan from the ground up to the object. No, it looks the most impressive footage I've ever seen.
So where is this now?
Chuck Clark has it, and he won't. And I tried for years, but apparently the two boys that shot it are terrified that they filmed some sort of secret government craft. They're going to get, you know. And I believe me, I tried, and I tried to the point where I think I pretty much damaged my relationship with Chuck Clark, trying to get it out of him. But I was just at Little Alien a couple of months, 2 months ago, and I talked to Pat, I believe it is, and Pat said that Chuck still has that footage.
Wow.
And
wow,
I promise you, if I can get my hands on it, is the most. But anyway, point being was that all the description I'd ever heard about the way they glow, you know, the light source, that's exactly what it looked like. It the whole thing just kind of glowed, this yellowy, orangey, and it just sat there, and it was like a top. It was just kind of, like it was kind of just wobbling a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can describe that to you guys. And the guy operating the camera, all he says is, oh, my God, just like this. That's all he says. And you're thinking the same thing when you're looking at it. You're going, what is this?
And it's all you need to hear anyway, isn't it?
It was amazing. Yeah, it's the most impressive footage I've ever seen.
Richard, what got you into this field?
Well, I backed in. I think, you know, when I hear James talking about this, I think he and I have very, very similar perspective on how, you know, how we look at this and how we got it. I got in through the back door. I was working on a PhD in history, Cold War studies, not having anything to do with UFOs. I was just studying Harry Truman and his relation with the Soviets and the birth of the Cold War. And in the early 1990s, I became a little bit interested in the UFO topic as a curiosity, thinking, gee, I wonder, you know, if there's something legitimate to this whole concept of a cover-up, then I would think it would have affected the period of, that I'm actually studying academically. And, of course, I knew that in the academic world, you cannot do this. You can't do UFOs. And then one day I saw a copy of Timothy Good's very classic book, Above Top Secret, and that was in 93 or 94, and I bought it. And I just thought, wow, I know this name and that department and this guy, and I read his diaries and so on. And this epiphany hit me, and I just asked myself whether – not are UFOs real? I wasn't even there yet. I was in a much more conservative place. It was, is this a legitimate topic of our history? Is this part of our history? even if it was a mistake on their part, is this something that important, powerful individuals studied? And if it is, why is it not in any single academic history book I've ever read? It's just completely expunged. I mean, would it not be interesting to go back to 1950 and some three-star, four-star generals concerned about these UFOs? Well, of course it's interesting. And so on that basis alone, I thought, I want to see, what can I learn about this? Is there a good argument that the believers make? What's the best documentation one can use? And that was 15 years ago. I thought it would be a six-month, three-month project, and it's taken the rest of my life.
When the U.S. Air Force released its Project Blue Book to the public during the Hynek era,
yeah,
could one say, well, they came first in terms of releasing their files? The Brits came way later. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
But you remember what Hynek said about that, you guys? Remember what Hynek said about that, Dr. Jalen Hynek? He said, you know, the cases that could be easily explained were made public, and the ones that weren't were put aside. I mean, he actually said that on camera.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's right. And there's a very specific historical document that makes the same statement, James. There's a general, Carol Bolander, in 1969, who, when they closed down Blue Book, which was a public investigation body that the Air Force had, Bolander said, well, it's really not a big deal because any UFO report that truly affects national security doesn't go through Blue Book channels anyway. So we have that statement. But it's true that the U.S. Air Force was really the first, if you want to say that they disclosed. I mean, they released the Blue Book files in the mid-70s, and those are available. Britain, at that point, was not releasing a thing. And, in fact, Britain's history of releasing documents, I think until – I'm looking forward to diving into – I really want to study this latest Ministry of Defense release because I think this could be a little more significant. But up till now, Britain's releases, in my opinion, have been very, very much portrayed as these great, great events and, frankly, have been a whole lot of nothing. I think Britain has a long history of doing this just as the U.S. government pretends to disclose. Remember 10 years ago, the CIA said, oh, yeah, we're disclosing about UFOs now. Remember all those UFOs people thought they saw? Well, that was the U-2 aircraft.
Yeah, I remember.
Not
that.
Much of a disclosure, but that's how they took it. Britain's very much the same way. They released the Rendlesham cases a few years ago that everyone made a big, big thing out of, and frankly, were just 50% of it were duplicate pages and blanked out pages and just, you know, nothing that was new.
Richard, did the Holt memo come out of England or did that come out of the U.S.?
I'm sorry, did the Holt what?
The Holt memo, did that come out of Britain or did that come out of the U.S.?
Oh, great question. That came out of Britain.
Okay.
That's right. The British, somehow it leaked out of Britain. I'm trying to review my own history of it. I just wrote about this for my next book. You'd think I remember a few things. I think it leaked out of Britain, but then the United States had its hand forced, essentially, because the existence of the document was acknowledged, and a U.S. version came out. Pretty sure I got that right.
Mm.
But actually, yeah, had that case taken place in the United States, I think
it's
very likely
known about it, huh?
The document would not have come out.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd have the story of Larry Warren, who's the first person that really pushed this. He was one of the airmen there. But, yeah, I don't know if we would have had supporting documentation. That Holt memo, Colonel Charles Holt just made the news today. He had his own recent statement, I believe, about what happened at Rendlesham. And this is why the Ministry of Defense release of documents, I think once again, is a bit overstated. You know, you have the New York Times now chiming in. Well, the MOD's release of documents shows there was a whole lot of nothing. Of course, you'd expect that, frankly,
sure,
from the New York Times. But, you know, with a guy like Charles Holt, who was the base commander at that institute facility.
Yeah, right. Bentwaters, Rendlesham.
Bentwaters, yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
You know, Holt was out there, and he said what we saw was absolutely intelligently controlled. He just made this statement. So now, let's put two and two together. The Ministry of Defense makes this big, big release yet again.
Yeah,
this is not in there.
Yeah, let me say something really quickly. You know that I met with General Gordon Williams last year?
Yes.
You know, and he was the commander of the whole base.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was so funny, you know, he wouldn't confirm nor deny the event. But the one thing that he was prepared to comment on, and I did this all on camera, is that he was very, very upset that Colonel Holt wrote that memo and the fact that it was released. And he said to me, and I said, well, why is that? And he said, because it had statements in there that we were not prepared to defend.
Wow, yeah.
He said this on camera.
He didn't say that they were false.
No, he did not.
They were not prepared to defend them.
Prepared to defend.
And that statement, there's probably people listening who may not know, but that statement is a very explicit, one-page, single-space type document by Colonel Holt, who was deputy base commander, about these very, very bizarre unidentified lights that were over the Bentwaters base in Britain. And, you know, you read through this document, it's very explicit stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah,
then,
it
and
is.
People it's, have expanded on that. But
I think it's almost better than Roswell.
Oh, you guys, you know what I did?
In terms of documentation, yes.
For the new film, for Beyond the Blue, or the working title, Beyond the Blue, I actually got, for the first time, Nevels and Holt together for the first time in 28 years. And Nevels was out with Holt. He's one of the guys on the on the tape recordings with Holt that night. And right at the point where the beam of light, I took the tape and I played it for both of them so they kind of relive it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I filmed all of this. But right at the point where the beam of light comes down at their feet, I stop the tape and I look at both and I say, what were you guys thinking right now?
I was like,
can you imagine how intense that was? They're out in the forest and all of a sudden this object shines a beam of light 5 feet down at their feet.
And presumably they're both reliving this in a very, very intense manner.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that I got them together, we went out to this little forest area. We didn't take it to go to England, but we went out and you know, we walked around and they described the intensity of that. I mean, could you imagine?
No, I mean, honestly, not having done it.
And then Holt was incredible. Saying, they were both saying that these objects were doing a grid pattern search. Well, they said, Paul said, well, they're looking for something. I said, how do you know? Because they said they were doing a grid pattern search, and they were shooting beams of light down into the weapons storage area.
That base had nukes, and no one knew it at the time, or other than a small, you know, select group.
Hey, James, we're going to lose you soon, so I want to get you to at least wrap up your portion with us. And what do you do next, James Fox? Of course, you're working on this movie, but you don't stop. What's next for you?
What my plan is, and I can't reveal all of it, But my plan is that I want to go on a tour. This is our exit strategy with the film. And I want to do a multi-city international tour along with a panel of high-ranking military and government officials and invite the media so there could be a Q&A session at the end of each, you know, screening and screen it in strategic areas. You know, maybe I have a number of different ideas of where to do this. So that... If I could get a bit of a media buzz going about the movie, I think that would increase our chances of getting it picked up by Sony or Miramax. Obviously, right now we're concentrating primarily on doing the best job we can. We've got a really, really good crew of people, a lot of great contacts in the media, but I really want to get a real buzz going. It's something to the, you know, of the caliber of the National Press Club event, but in multiple cities.
Well, you're a home run. James Fox, Richard Dolan will stay with us. Because next, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Richard Dolan about some of the things you've heard tonight, and maybe you had a close encounter of the third kind. Richard, what are some of the best UFO cases that you've investigated or at least found some documents on?
Well, there's a really, really good short list of key UFO documents that I have been kind of sifting through, and I think in terms of something that I would present to a skeptical or on the fence public, the 1981 Holt memo that we were discussing along with James Fox earlier, I think is one document relating to the Rendlesham case that is extremely important. There's a couple of classic cases that I think just will never, ever lose their importance. There is a very famous series of jet interceptions in 1976 over Tehran. Now, this was back in the days when the Shah was alive and Iran was an ally of the United States. And back then, the citizens of Tehran saw this blinding light in the sky above their city. They called their local airport, who then contacted the Iranian Air Force, which, of course, was supplied with F-4 jets courtesy of the United States. There are two successive attempts by F-4s to intercept this object. We have extensive documentation on this. Each time those F-4 fighter planes came within 25 nautical miles of this object, their communications and electronic systems went offline. It's an incredible thing, and this is all written about in a document that was CC'd to the U.S. State Department, that is to Henry Kissinger, to the President of the United States, that is Gerald Ford. I mean, holy...
We had the Iranian pilot on some time ago.
Yes, yes.
Who was one of those. I mean,
he became a general, I believe.
And, incredible guy.
So I think that's a very, very excellent historical case. There's just no shortage of current cases happening. I think the Stephenville, Texas case has potential to be one of the most important of our recent history because of the number of witnesses, the caliber of the number of these people who've come forth to talk, and the fact that this is an investigation still ongoing. And in the Stephenville case, this is yet another in a long line of confrontational accounts. That is, you've got F-16 jets chasing this, by all accounts, enormous, just gargantuan-sized object that's just not supposed to exist. And you got upwards of 50 people who said they saw this happen. The Air Force, who would want to be the poor Air Force guy to have to talk to the public about this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The Air Force originally said, no, they probably just saw a reflection of a landing commercial airliner. And all the witnesses, no, that's insane. And what I think was going to happen, maybe you can correct me on this, but it looked to me that it was going to come out that F-16s were in the area. And what the Air Force did was to say, oh, well, yeah, we did have a couple of F-16s there out on a training mission. So the Air Force did corroborate the existence of F-16s. And now what we need to do is corroborate the huge thing that was described by one witness as a flying Walmart.
Exactly.
So I think the Stephenville case, that's just January 2008, that this is a very important case. I also believe the O'Hare case of November of 2006, it's gotten, just like Stephenville, it's gotten major media attention. You know, the thing that makes a case important to me is it's twofold. One is you need good supporting evidence for it, obviously, that's key. But the other thing is that if it is able to get some public traction in some way, that makes it important as well, obviously, because from a public relations point of view, it becomes very important. So I think the Stephenville and O'Hare cases are important. And then, of course, go back to 2002, not that long ago, still post 9/11 America, right outside Washington, D.C., there were a number of people who saw late at night more F-16s chasing a bluish type of object that, by all accounts, totally outmaneuvered them as well.
Okay.
And that's, I think, the main witnesses were in Waldorf, Maryland, which is just a quick drive out of D.C. And I spoke to one of those witnesses myself, Rennie Rogers. And there were a number of other people who called in that sighting to their local radio station. So, you know, as I was saying earlier in this interview, George, there's many facets of the UFO phenomenon that are very interesting, but one thing that I try not to lose sight of is the fact that our military is chasing these things, and that's important because...
And can't catch them.
We can't catch them, and if these are a secret terrestrial, you know, something from the black budget, a deeply secret program, then my question is, why are our militaries constantly chasing them? I mean, if it's a U.S. secret program, then what's going on here with scrambling our jets year after year to try to track these things down? This makes no sense to me. You know? Does it make sense to you?
Nope, not at all. Let's take some calls. You ready, Richard?
As ready as I'll ever be.
West of the Rockies. Let's go to you, Tony, in Upland, California.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I'm calling in just to let you know about an experience that I had when I was about 14 years old. Don't get surprised now, but this happened to me in Coyama, Mexico. I don't know if that rings a bell.
Mexico or New Mexico? I didn't hear you.
Mexico.
Okay.
Coyama, Mexico, northern Chihuahua.
Okay.
And I had no idea about the this UFO crash until about maybe 2 years ago. I did at one time report to MUFON LA about what happened to me when I was a kid. And basically, a couple nights before, and by the way, I've been in law enforcement for 25 years, so the credibility is there. We went out jackrabbit hunting with my cousins, and we did spot some lights, and they did mention things about, that we see them all the time. And a couple nights after that, I went out to a field to gather some alfalfa for a horse that I'd ridden all day, and I spotted what appeared to be a small person, but it had glowing amber red eyes. And it wasn't until I heard about the incident down in Brazil. I don't recall the name of the town.
Maybe the Varginha case,
that's,
1997?
Exactly. When I saw the pictures of those, it really scared the heck out of me. Because
what year do you remember what year this happened to you?
Well, we always vacationed down there every summer, and it was around the summer of 1974 when this occurred.
Okay, coming back.
And what really caught my attention was the fact that, you know, a couple of years ago I saw on the History Channel the saucer crash that occurred in just outside of Coyama, Mexico, and that just really blew my mind.
These things have gone down, it seems to me, in all parts of the world. As far as what you saw, sir, you know, clearly if someone wanted to try to debunk your case, I'm sure they could make all kinds of attempts, but you're obviously aware that there are many claims by eyewitnesses to have seen glowing reddish types of eyes from these other creatures.
Right.
Not just Varginha. You get this a number of times. And it's just one of those stories that sounds so outrageous until you start going through the research and you find they pop up again and again. When you saw this, let me ask you, how did you react? How did this thing react? Did it see you? Did you interact with it in some way or what?
It appeared to be floating, actually. And I dropped everything I had. I had a knife that I was cutting the alfalfa with, and I just turned and ran.
You just ran, yeah.
Probably it just scared the bejesus out of me. And when I got home, actually to the ranch, told my grandmother about it. I told everyone about it, and, you know, basically they came out with you were bad, so the devil, you know. And my grandmother actually sat down, and I wish I would have saved that little drawing that she drew. But she drew a little picture of what appeared to be an alien, and, you know, big eyes, the whole nine yards. And I said, that's exactly what I saw. Of course, so, Spanish.
She's saying that she saw the same thing at some point?
Well, no. The ironic thing is that she said that they would see them often in the ranch, and they would steal the salt licks, you know, those big blocks of salt that they put out for the cattle.
Really?
And, exactly. And that's always stuck in my mind since back then. I'm 49 years old now, and, you know, a lot of this stuff just never ceases to amaze me. And actually, even as a police officer, I don't want to say where I work, but you can get a pretty good idea. I emailed your show or the show in regard to an incident when I was listening to the Nye incidents, an investigation that I had up in the Griffith Park area. And that's another, a whole other story.
Mm-hmm.
But
now you just told us where you are, but that's okay.
You're busted, man.
Well, you know, a lot of my friends.
Thank you, though. Seriously, that's a very fascinating encounter, and
I don't know what
one can do with it. You know, you have to live with that and digest that probably for the rest of your life.
Why do people, Richard, weigh the perception of witnesses? Here's my example. Very credible. He's a police officer, right?
Right.
But is his testimony, is his eyewitness account any more possible or plausible than let's say, a guy who works at a fast food store or anything like that. If you heard the two, I bet 85% of the public, maybe more, would believe the account of the police officer than the other guy. And they're probably both compelling stories.
I agree with you totally, George. And, you know, both of us have spoken with many, many people firsthand, face-to-face, who've had incredible stories. In my daily life, people find out that I'm this UFO researcher. They inevitably tell me a story. Let me tell you what I saw 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whenever. I don't solicit them. So I'm face-to-face with many people who tell me amazing things, and they're from all walks of life. And it is true. I've talked to some people who are famous and others who are basically sweep floors for a living. And the nature of the stories really doesn't vary very much from person to person. Their level of education will determine how clearly or how well they might tell the story, but they're basically, they got the same credibility. Skeptics are constantly trying to throw cold water on all these witnesses. And, I mean, there was one skeptic who recently was talking about the, I think it was the O'Hare sighting, who said pilots are not reliable judges of what's in the air. Did you hear about this?
Yes. Yes.
What a
Can
crock.
You believe that? Boy, if they're not, we're all in trouble.
So, but yes, I think, I mean, hey, my dad is a retired police officer and I grew up around cops. You know, they can be pretty wild guys, let me just say that. But if a police officer were to tell me about a clear observation that he or she had, you bet I'd listen carefully.
You would.
Absolutely.
You sure would.
Absolutely.
Wild card line, Eric in Atlanta. You're on Coast to Coast. Hey, Eric.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Norrie. Good morning, Mr. Doan. How are you all doing?
Hey, Eric. Great.
Hey, good. It's 4:20 out here on the East Coast, and I got to have knee surgery tomorrow, so I'm going to give this my best shot.
I'm on the East Coast, man. I'm with you. I feel your pain.
My name is Eric, like I say, and I'm 25 years old, but I'm just as I take the subject just as serious as you do, Mr. Doan, even though you're much more high profile than I am. My initials are ET, believe it or not. I was born the same year that ET the movie hit theaters, so I always get crack ups from people from that. But I got really interested in it, the subject, I'd say about 10 years ago when I was 15. My grandfather, who is a head judge of upstate New York, I won't name the city, the town, but in 1971, he was a sheriff in the Albany County, New York Sheriff Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a UFO hover over him and shine a beam of light down. And it's a long story. He went to a woman's house, and her dogs were acting strange. And he contacted the Albany Airport Control Tower, and they said that they hadn't tracked anything on radar, but they had received a lot of phone calls, and
mm-hmm.
it was in the Altamont Enterprise newspaper. So ever since then, I've just really, you know, dug into this stuff for as much as I can and whatnot. I keep in contact with Nick Pope. He told me something pretty interesting the other day about how the U.S. kind of took the testimony from Peniston and Hull and didn't really give it to the MOD. And something about the MOD, you know, kept the Geiger information, didn't give it to the U.S. So he said, you know, their investigation, the MOD, you know, Mr. Paul Webb is the guy who has Nick Pope's job now. And I talked to him, and he's like, you know, the MOD's stance is that that happened 20 years ago, and we still feel that it was of no defense significance, which is total baloney, you know.
Right.
So, anyways, as soon as I heard about Ricky Sorrells, became highly interested and, you know, read up on the details of it, got in touch with him, and, you know, correspond with him over the phone a lot. And,
oh, Rick, one of the main Stephenville witnesses.
Yeah, yeah, and we just had him on, Richard, before you came on, by the way.
Ah, great.
Yep.
Okay.
Make a long story short, I call a lot of people, and I really don't care what kind of trouble I get in. I might should, but his sighting actually occurred mid-December 07. Now, when he got with Linda Howell, they came up with January 1st, but you can ask Ricky. It was in mid-December 07, so it was just before, you know, the main January 8th, you know, Stephenville sighting.
Okay.
So after I got all his details and talked to him. I figured, heck, I'll try to call around and get some information. So mid to late January, I called the Carl Lewis, the public affairs officer for the 301st Fighter Wing stationed in Fort Worth.
Yes.
You know, the Joint Naval Air Station.
Right.
I told him, you know, I know a guy that lives in Dublin. I didn't mention Ricky's name. I said he was hunting on his property. I told him all the details, what he saw, a large UFO. It took off with a blink of an eye. It was silent. And I said, did y'all happen to track anything on radar around mid-December that was abnormally large and fast, you know, a UFO? And he said, well, if anything was tracked, then I should contact the FAA. And I said, well, can you at least, like, speculate on what he might have seen? And he said, no, I can't speculate. All I can tell you is that we had F-16s up in the air around January 8th. I said, okay. I called the FAA South Central, control center. My father, he's retiring from the FAA this year, and he actually met John Callahan, who he was involved in the 1986 Japanese.
Yeah, very important airliner case.
And he met with my father once up in D.C. So anyways, talked to this FAA guy in Fort Worth, I believe it was. He said, yeah, I heard about this incident. You're looking for information? I said, yeah. And he said, well, FAA only tracks aircraft with transponders, you know, they send radar signals back and forth between the airplane and the control tower. We don't track UFOs or secret military craft, he told me. So I said, okay. He said, I call NORAD. So I called NORAD, and they say, well, we only track man-made objects in space. We don't track UFOs. We don't track meteorites. We don't track planes. I said, okay. So they said, can we transfer you to Lackland Air Force Base? I said, sure. So this major so-and-so answers the phone, and just like Ricky, I didn't write down the guy's name. And in hindsight, you better believe I wish I would have.
Did he help you out?
Well, he says, hello, this is Major so-and-so. What can I do for you? I said, the same thing I said to Carl Lewis. I said, I know a guy in Dublin, Texas, gave him the whole spiel.
Right.
And did you guys track anything? He said, well, that would be classified, and I couldn't tell you. In a real aggravated tone.
Yeah, typical. Back in a moment. Richard Dolan, do you think the public could accept the fact that the government came out and said, okay, we've been visited, this planet's been visited, you're probably seeded, and there's nothing we can do about it? Do you think people can handle that?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people would be able to handle that information. I think a lot of people listening to this show right now are going to be in a better position to handle it than the general public, just because they've taken the time and effort to become acquainted with what's going on. I do think that there are going to be many, many people who will have a very hard time with this. Some of that will be for religious purposes. I think, you know, certain very conservative religious belief systems do not make it easy for people to accept this. Some of the bravest people that I know are very conservative Christians who grew up in an environment where belief in this kind of thing is just considered evil and wrong. And yet there are people who dive into it anyway. So there's a lot of resistance. The other thing that's going to be difficult, George, I think, is once the full implications become explored. I mean, this is such a deep and broad topic that affects every aspect of our life when you really start getting into it, and they're all going to be affected. Financial, for example. I mean, I start now thinking of the financial effects of an ET reality. For example, what if it turns out that they have a better, version of our petroleum? Well, I think we would all love that. We're paying so much money for gasoline these days. But there would be financial interest in the short term that would take a major hit. What if they make a better version of our steel?
Mm-hmm.
In the long run, for our civilization, these would be, you know, great things. But in the short term, they would cause a lot of financial disruption. Then there's the threat of lawsuits galore. You can just imagine. There'd be a ton of these. And against people who've been keeping secrets. I can guarantee you that one thing that those people want before anything else is protection against legal action.
True.
Once this truth comes out.
True.
And then one other thing I can easily see happening is once this comes out, you're going to see a new party system in this country, and it will be very much along the lines of traditional like third world countries when they start dealing with the West. That is, you'll have the modernizers, and then you'll have the traditionalists. And here, too, I guarantee you there'd be one group, large group of people who would say, we need to be more like the extraterrestrials. They're more advanced. They do this. They do that. And you'd have an enormous group of people who would say, no, we need to retain what is our essential humanity. We can't be like them. We lose that. And so it would really cause a complete transformation. And frankly, I don't think most of us are going to be ready for it, but that won't stop it from happening. Our culture as it is right now, I don't think is sufficiently preparing us. There are hints being dropped here and there, but I think by and large, most people go through their daily lives. They don't really think too much about this. They got other things on their plate. And when this comes down, it's going to come down really hard, and it's going to transform everything.
And fast when it happens.
Yeah, I think it will happen very unexpectedly. Within like 1 week, it'll be like nothing happened. And then next week, I bet it'll be like a complete transformation. I think.
Will it be a mistake, Richard? Something happened and they have to tell us? Will it come out that way?
Yeah, I think it won't happen as a result of a carefully orchestrated plan. I do think it will happen as a result of somebody's hand being forced. And I think very likely something like the Stephenville case could do it conceivably. In other words, a very major event. Had the Phoenix Lights of 1997 occurred a few hours earlier in the day when it was daylight.
Absolutely.
Can you imagine? Right?
Absolutely.
So this kind of thing can happen, and one day it will happen, and when it does, it's going to be a very, very rapid unraveling of the secrecy.
Back to the phones we go. West of the Rockies, April, you're on the air with us. Hey, April.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi, April.
Hi. Okay, so I have, actually a couple questions, quick ones, but one of them, the main one. I kind of understand, but I don't really understand. Like, why is hiding extraterrestrial, like, aliens, like, why is it so big to hide it? Why is the government hiding it from us?
Okay.
I mean, if something's going to happen later in the future anyway, and we're going to find out about it anyway, shouldn't they be preparing us for it instead of,
we think it's control, April. I think they're afraid of losing control.
Yeah.
I go back 50, 60 years. Pretend that you're the president of the United States back in the 1940s. So you're Harry Truman.
Okay.
And your top scientist or general comes up to you and says, sir, we've recovered technology that doesn't appear to have originated from our civilization. So you got this bombshell dropped on you, right?
Okay.
So now what do you do with it? Do you tell the world? Well, keep in mind, in the 1940s, we had this Cold War going on, and the U.S. and the Soviets were not getting along. And so if you've got this technology, this very exotic stuff now that you've got in your possession, if you tell the world that you have it, it's going to make it very, very difficult not to share it with other parties, and you may not want to share it with other parties. So there's that, and that might be one reason the secrecy begins. Another reason might be that someone like Truman would think, okay, hold on, let's figure out, do we need to, who are these other beings? Do we have anything to worry about? Let's not drop the bombshell on the public until we know what we're talking about. So there might be very legitimate reasons to start the secrecy. I think happens is that secrecy develops its own momentum, however, and its own profit, by the way. So that one thing I've argued for a number of years is that the possession of this technology has gone into private defense contractor corporate interests, and I think that they're making some very good money off of this. By studying the technology, coming up with nifty ideas for further developments. And so they really have no incentive for giving up this goose that lays golden eggs. And then, of course, it becomes a public relations problem. How do you tell the world that you've been lying to them for decade after decade? You know, these things build up and they become more and more difficult. So I think that in a lot of ways, these people who are in possession of this secret have backed themselves into a very difficult corner.
So Sorry. It's kind of back to the theory that knowledge is power. But, isn't power also knowledge? Like, in order to have good power, to be able to use it, like, rightfully and everything, And in a good way, you have to have a lot of knowledge because you can do something that can harm the planet and everything. And
right.
I'm not too sure if aliens are dangerous or if they're not or what or anything, but either way, I mean, in my opinion, I still think that they should be trying to get us ready for it rather than hiding us. I mean, I do understand what you're saying. That makes a lot of sense. But I still think that they should at least let us know a little bit about it.
I'm not necessarily defending their actions.
Oh, no, I know. I know.
I believe in the truth as much as you do. And you're coming from a very logical position, which is that the government should be acting the way it's supposed to act, which is in the best interest of the broader community, and not lie to people year after year, decade after decade, which is what they've been doing. The motivations back then might have been noble, but now we're talking 60-plus years. And, you know, you lie to the world for 60 years, and bad things are going to happen, and I think that's where we're at. But they're not always acting from a generous public policy point of view. I don't know if they're always looking out for our interests.
Not at all. First time caller line, Michael in Pennsylvania. You're on the air with us. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Hello, George and Richard.
Hi, Mike.
I'm listening to the compelling sighting stories, and I was wondering about abductions. I was wondering, could you give me maybe one compelling abduction case? And also, secondary point is, what usually happens during an abduction? And I'll take my answer offline.
Sure. One compelling abduction case. Well, I think that there are quite a few. The thing about abductions, I'll just start off and say that I do believe that they are happening. I think that they are probably fairly common. How common, I couldn't tell you. I don't know. And no one's got statistics on this sort of thing, of course. The thing about these other beings who are taking humans is that they have the ability to manipulate the human mind. And this is an unsettling thing, but it's absolutely undeniable when you look at the sum total of abduction literature. People get taken, they get switched on, they get switched off, their memories are basically erased when they get brought back, but they have vague memories of something that happened. These other beings have the ability to mess with our heads. And beyond all else, we have to keep this in mind. A very good abduction case. Well, I'm still fond of the Travis Walton case of 1975. I think that's a very good case. Travis Walton, of course, was a forest worker who was with a crew of a bunch of other guys, and a light in the sky approached them as they were going home. He gets hit in the chest with a beam of light, gone for several days. The thing about that case is that Travis and his coworkers all took polygraph tests, and they did very well with those polygraph tests, in my opinion. There are many, many cases that are not spectacular, however. I myself sat in on a hypnotic regression on one particular abduction case, and all I can say is that the person doing the regression was a very qualified PhD psychiatrist who did not, in absolutely no way, did this person lead the experiencer on with any kind of leading questions, and yet what came out was a classic abduction case. What they do is they take you, they take us, and typically what is involved has to do with human reproduction and human DNA. These other beings are very interested in our DNA. That, I think, there's no question about it. It seems to me that they're creating variant species based on our DNA and probably their DNA, is what it looks like, and for purposes, you know, that are really unknown at this point. I mean, is it for them to take over? Well, I don't know. But they're creating what have been called transgenic beings for some time now. I think just as we would if we were on another world, needing from time to time to interact with that dominant species over there, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be able to walk around on their planet. Their sun might be bad. There might be microbes that would be harmful to us. So we might want to create a genetic variant that would still be working for us, but that would be able to live on that world. And I think that's what they are doing with us.
Good point. Let's move on to our wild card line. Ray in Gainesville, Florida, your turn. Go ahead, Ray.
Good evening. Good morning, George, and your guest. I forget his name.
Richard.
Richard. Listen, I got a question and a comment. The comment is I think gravity waves are what allows the ETs to create energy. But anyway, my question is, I don't believe that I think the ET wants full disclosure. And I don't think it's religion or the general public is the fear. I think it's big oil that is fear and trembling that they know that their game is about to be over and that they're putting pressure, I think, on the, is it, don't you think this is true, that they're putting pressure on all the governments around the world to keep disclosure from happening, and that's why they're sending airplanes up to fire at the ETs. They're trying to keep full disclosure from taking place because they know that once it's happening, then there's free energy, and except for oil, and I mean lubricating oils and chemicals, that we would need big oil.
You could be very well right about that. I actually am not disagreeing with you. You know, go back to 1960 when the world was a very different place, and back in 1960, the amount of oil consumption globally was much, much lower than it is today, and policymakers could say, hey, you know what? We don't really need to worry about free energy right now because we've got all this petroleum. It's really easy. It's easy, very easy to get out of the ground. Let's just, you know, wait. Okay, we're not in any particular situation where we have to worry. Now it's a little different. Now we've got China. We've got India. Global demand for this product is doubling basically every 20 years, and so it's a little tight now, right? So it could very well be that big oil is the primary driver for secrecy. My suspicion is that big oil is one major group. They're probably not the only group. I think that there are significant financial interests in addition to oil that would be affected by this. But, yeah, I think your point's well taken.
Okay, time for maybe one or two more. Let's go to our wild card line, Harry in Texas. Go ahead, Harry. You're on with Rich Dolan.
Hello, Rich. Hello, George. I'd like to describe something that happened back in 78 to me, and I've never really talked to anybody about it except my wife. And I was always a skeptic, but when I saw this, I've just got the most strange mixed emotions about it. It's almost like it was a dream. What happened was, it's about 77 or 78, I had left my apartment, walking out of the courtyard, and I heard a whooshing sound, almost like an escaping gas overhead. When I looked up, I saw this enormous ring, circular ring, and it had a bluish and yellowish, at the time I described it as looked like flames, but it wasn't flames, it was more like plasma, now that I know that term. And it revolved around it, and it would become, you know, thicker and protrude from the ring, more in some areas than others, but it made like a circular motion, and it revolved clockwise and counterclockwise. Well, my first impression was that it was just above the treetops. And when I saw this, my first thought was, I got to go knock on the door of the apartment closest to me and get somebody else to witness it. But then I got this overwhelming feeling of, no, stand here and experience it. And believe it or not, I was thinking, I want to go.
Uh-huh.
And those were my thoughts. And I stood there for about 3 or 4 minutes watching it. And I noticed when I looked up inside the ring, I could see the stars in the center through it. So it appeared there was nothing there in the middle. It was just this plasma ring.
Hmm.
And then I got a better judgment for how large it was, because then it started floating off towards a power plant that was about a half a mile from our apartment. It floated over to the power plant. It reached there pretty quick. But it didn't zip. It just kind of seemed like it was floating.
Mm-hmm.
Got over there quickly, came back to me after a few minutes, hovered over me again for a few more minutes, then went out towards the airport, which was about 6 miles away. Now, the reason I say it was much larger than my first impression is because when it went to the airport, I continued to see it miles and miles away. It was still a very large ring, and it was, you know, high enough in the sky that it was above the treetops because there's very large trees around me.
Richard, they're all over the place. We're out of time. It's the end of the program.
Wow.
Richard Dolan, thank you so much, my friend.
My pleasure. My pleasure. That last gentleman, by the way, 1978 was a huge year for UFOs. It's going into my next book, UFOs in a National Security State, Volume 2. So stay tuned for that.
KeyholePublishing.com. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.